listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, pigs are flying, I guess. The Pope has said he's not going to judge gay priests. God bless this guy. He keeps coming out with new and improved versions of papacy. Anyhow, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's bright, fresh, new Monday. Tom Hartman here with you. And, you know, the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman, the Trayvon Martin killing, the George Zimmerman trial still echoing in the media, the stand your ground laws in 31 states, and in some states they don't even call them that, but they're basically the same thing. It's getting weird out there. The Daily Kos has a running total of it. I should have brought it up. Every week they do. There was a couple of 2-year-olds, a couple of 3-year-olds, a half a dozen 4 or 5-year-olds. Altogether a couple dozen kids who were killed by accidental discharge or kids playing with firearms at home. Not so much, crimes stopped by anybody, at least that we know about, but. Bill Frady is with us. He's the host of Lock and Load Radio, presented by Gun Owners of America. The website is lockandloadradio.com. Hey, Bill.
Tom, how are you?
I am fine. So what are your listeners saying about Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws? And also about this group that is sending $12,000 to George Zimmerman to go out and buy some guns.
Well, I mean, we at Gun Owners of America offered to get him a gun.
Uh-huh. Why would you do that?
Well, because he does have a lot of death threats against him for being exonerated, and he is not on a prohibited list.
Now, this is a guy who's assaulted an armed police officer and was arrested for it. This is a guy whose girlfriend took out a restraining order against him. Has a history of violence, and you want to give him a gun? And by the way, I forgot, he murdered a 17-year-old, or he killed a 17-year-old.
Was the, and how did that shooting...
Well, Bill, you don't know, and I don't know. We just know that he got out of his car with a gun, and the 17-year-old who was committing no crime is now dead.
Do you know who Roderick Scott is?
No.
Roderick Scott is a black American male who shot an unarmed 17-year-old white person that was running at him to attack him. And he also was exonerated for that shooting.
Oh, my. He must be the exception that proves the rule.
Oh, no, in Florida.
But, Bill, you haven't answered my question. Why do you want to give a gun to a guy with a history of violence who's already killed one human being and has had two other and has attacked an armed police officer and been arrested for it and had a restraining order taken out against him by his girlfriend? I mean, I get it. His dad's a judge he apparently gets good treatment in that county.
I haven't heard about the other two things, but I do know that he was exonerated for that. Apparently in the state of Florida, he was legally carrying a gun. He had a concealed carry permit. Yeah. I think they would have taken his past transgressions like they do everywhere else into
No, they were ruled inadmissible because they did not involve convictions for a crime. When he assaulted the police officer, ultimately his daddy, the judge, stepped in and they saw it. They resolved that case without charges. And when his girlfriend had the restraining order against him, ultimately that dissolved when he moved away and the girlfriend moved away or whatever.
Okay, so he also has a history of philanthropy. He's worked with underprivileged people. He just rescued somebody from an overturned vehicle.
Yeah, after his good friend, a police officer, called him from the scene. I mean, you're really going to pull that one out, Bill?
What does it matter?
Well, I think the larger issue here is not George Zimmerman. I'll agree with you on that, Bill. I think the larger issue here is, and this gets back to my question about why do you want to give this guy a gun? Why would you want to give anybody a gun? We have the most guns per capita in the world, and we have the most homicides by gun per capita in the world. Surprise, surprise. Isn't it time to do something about this instead of kowtowing to the manufacturers of weapons?
Well, we don't kowtow to the manufacturers of weapons. In fact,
no, you just do their work for them.
In fact, if you were to look at where most of these crimes happen, most of them occur in 3% of the counties where they have heavy gun restrictions.
Right, and where you have a very, very high levels of poverty. This is you know, Bill O'Reilly going off on his racist rant. If you look at poverty rather than race, you can simply exchange those terms. When you have high levels of poverty, you're going to have high levels of unemployment. You're going to have high levels of single motherdom. In fact, because poverty's gotten so bad in the white community, the white single motherdom level right now is about equal to that of black single mothers. But Bill O'Reilly somehow missed that fact. And when you look at violence, the poorer somebody is, and particularly the poorer they were born, the family they were born into, the more likely they are to end up at some point in their life convicted of a violent crime. Why don't we do something about violence instead of people, you know, your perception is not enough people own guns. My perception is we've got too much poverty in this country.
Well, see, right now you're telling me what my perception is, which I don't really
Okay,
know
what
I
is your perception then, Bill?
That. What I know is that where they have a lot of heavy gun restriction, they also have a lot of liberal policies in place. And that, yes, there are a lot of poor people there, but why are they not surrounded by crime in the urban areas where they have so many guns if guns are the problem?
Because the urban areas are not poor.
Why is it that, you know, while you're out there talking about murder per capita, what is our murder rate per 100,000, Tom?
I'm telling you, you are not seeing those murders.
What is our murder rate per 100,000, Tom?
I don't know off the top of my head, Bill. I'm guessing you do. This is your business.
It's 4.7.
Okay.
It's 4.7, which is about average.
And what is it in France?
It is lower than it is in Europe. But in Europe, for example, in England, where they barely have guns at all, you have 2,034 violent crimes per 100,000, where we have 412. Does it matter to you if you're out there walking around, no matter what your political persuasion is, or no matter however you may look, if somebody comes at you to beat you with a brick, does that matter to you? Do they have the moral high ground? They're not using a gun.
Are you suggesting? Well, actually, I know you're suggesting this, that we should have more guns in America, right? We'll have less crime if we have more guns?
If you are not on a prohibited person's list, you certainly shouldn't be restricted from it. But if based upon your theory that you're putting forth here.
My theory is that poverty is the thing that drives violence, and that having guns available increases the probability that that violence will be lethal. If you look at the statistics in England, you got a lot of violence in England. You have very few gun killings in England compared to the United States.
Does
Why? Because they don't have guns.
With a club?
Yeah, I'd much rather get hit with a club than shot with a gun. Sure.
You're being sort of disingenuous.
No, I'm not.
That takes a long time. I would rather be in a position to fight back. I don't want to be in a position to just take it. But if your theory about more guns is valid, we should be awash in blood, which we're not.
Then we're not as well. Who defines awash in blood? I think. We've had more people die since George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin than died in 9/11. Two or three times more people than died on 9/11. That's not a wash in blood.
Where are they dying?
No, they're dying at the end of a barrel of a gun, dying from bullets.
Are they dying in the 3% of the counties that I mentioned earlier?
Does it matter?
Yeah, it does matter because if they're out there.
Oh, because those are poor counties. To hell with them.
No, I think everybody out there.
They're minority counties. To hell with them.
No, you know what? I believe that self-defense is an equal opportunity sort of concept. I served in the military where I got to learn exactly.
Bill, I'm going to leave you with that as the last word. Thank you, Bill. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bill Frady, Lock and Load Radio, lockandloadradio.com. Thank you, Bill, for dropping by. Americans is going to experience extreme poverty in their lifetimes. Excuse me, 4 out of 5 Americans. 1 out of 5 Americans will escape it. Just let that sink in for a minute. We have billionaires in this country like nobody's business. And 4 out of 5 Americans are going to experience poverty at some point in their life. I mean, you know, extreme poverty. This is just absolutely extraordinary. This is not the America that Dwight Eisenhower envisioned. It's not the America that Richard Nixon envisioned. It's not the America that George Herbert Walker, well, maybe it is him. It's certainly not the America that Teddy Roosevelt envisioned or William Howard Taft. I don't know how far back I can go in with Republican presidents. It's certainly not the America Abraham Lincoln envisioned. I mean, it may well be the America that Herbert Hoover and Calvin Coolidge and Warren Harding envisioned. And George W. Bush is probably just fine with it. But, you know, apparently he's quite fine with it because he was the most recent president who had an opportunity to do something about it. But we all seem to ignore poverty in America. I mean, to the point where Bill Clinton felt comfortable saying welfare as we know it is over. You know, we're going to end welfare as we know it. Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. Give people some boots with bootstraps that they can pull themselves up by, and they will. But they've got to have a basic starting point. People are not born literate. And they're not always born into families that are literate. If you want to break the cycle of poverty, you have to insert yourself into that cycle and lift somebody at least up to the upper edge of poverty, you know, or the bottom edge of the middle class, so that they can have that experience and move forward and raise the next generation a little better than them, and on it goes. And if we're going to freak out about gun violence in the United States, we need to look at, you know, as Bill Frady actually correctly pointed out, we need to look at all violence. And if we have all this violence in the United States, and you know, it's we are one of the most, we, you know, us, Singapore, the United Kingdom, we're among the most unequal of the fully developed nations. And so we're into this mix, into this toxic mix of severe poverty, of, you know, hopelessness and helplessness in many cases. You're going to throw guns? Now, the most common use for a gun, by the way, in the United States is suicide. And there was another really interesting study published over the weekend, I believe in the New York Times, that pointed out that depression goes up with poverty. That as people become poorer and poorer, they feel less and less control over their lives. And there is some kind of a trigger point. There's a tipping point, a breakover point, which is, you know, basically where a person is no longer earning enough money that they can afford to, you know, have health care and have housing and food and transportation reliably. And when they're making so little money, when they're making below that point, and they're having to say, okay, you know, am I going to eat today, or am I going to take my blood pressure medication, or am I going to, you know, sleep on the street next week? There's that certain point where people are so, they have lost so much basic security that they feel like they've lost control of their lives. And at that point, they start getting really depressed. Depression is associated with helplessness, and helplessness is associated with poverty or the feelings of helplessness. And then you introduce guns into that mixture. And what do you have? Suicide. This takes us back to the BBC back in 2002, September 18, 2002. The headline, BBC News. This is not an op-ed. This is a news report. The suicide rate, in the first sentence of the article, the suicide rate increases under conservative governments, research suggests. They analyzed suicide statistics from New South Wales. This is one of the states, what we would call a state or a province in Australia. Between 1901, when the federal government was established, and 1998, which in 2001, when they were doing this research, was the most recent year they had the statistics for. They filtered out the impact of World War II. The researchers took into account periods of drought and World War II because of their economic and psychological effect. But after adjusting for these factors, the figures clearly showed the highest rates of suicide occurred when both conservative state and federal governments were in power. Conversely, the lowest rates of suicide occurred when state and federal governments were both Labor. Labor Party in Australia and the UK, same thing as the Democrats in the United States. They say there's similar numbers for the United Kingdom, and then they wrap up by saying, actually, the last sentence was the UK Conservative Party refused to comment on the research. But the paragraph that precedes that is, overall, they say the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the Conservatives not been in power, equivalent to one suicide every day of the 20th century or two for every day that the Conservatives ruled. Again, that being the main thing that people use guns for. Now, what does conservative rule have to do with this? Well, conservative rule, I mean, look at what's going on in North Carolina. No, we don't want no stinking Medicare money. It makes poverty worse. Obamacare, we don't want any Obama. Make poverty worse. Make poverty more brutal. That's what conservatives do. And guess what? It drives suicide and homicide.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then the gun companies and the gun manufacturing companies and their spokesman, Wayne Little Peter, come along and say, oh, let's throw more guns into this thing. Really? Talking back to the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Talking back, taking back, all of the above. Kelly in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Kelly.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. Welcome to Anything Goes Summer. You wanted to talk about our guest and why would we want to arm George Zimmerman and others like him?
Absolutely. You know, something, I don't even think he hears it himself. You know, when you told him, and I didn't know this myself, when you told him, why would you give him a gun if he assaulted a police officer and was arrested for it? And why would you give him a gun if he did something to his girlfriend and she put a protection order out on her?
Right.
And his remark was, I didn't know about that. Well, geez, isn't that why we need background checks? Really?
Yeah, there you
go. If I did a background check on George Zimmerman, I bet you that man still would have given him that gun.
Well, they would have because, like I said, neither one of those things ended in any sort of criminal conviction, and so it wouldn't have been on his record. Although it may be that, you know, I don't know how they do the background checks now for gun owners. I think that it requires a conviction, but you would think that if anybody had ever had a restraining order against them, that would be at least a red flag in my mind. So, I mean, if they're gonna keep felons from voting, somebody who smoked pot and went to jail for it, or just got arrested for it and got convicted of a felony, no longer can you vote, then, you know, we should at least consider having people who have been the perpetrators of domestic violence not be allowed to buy a gun. So, yeah, I'm with you. Kelly, excellent. That is an excellent answer. That's why we need background checks. Perfect. Thank you. Jerry in Paradise, California. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hi, Mr. Hartman. How are you doing?
I am well.
I just watched a documentary through Netflix, a 2010 documentary called Murder by Proxy, How America Went Postal.
I haven't seen it.
Have you heard of it?
No.
It just basically talks about how the, since Reagan started breaking down or tearing down unions, how the workplace environment has just degraded to what we're seeing with our economy in general. And how it motivates people to resort to violence, usually with a gun, and it's bleeding out into the civilian life. Mm. And Zimmerman is probably,
a symptom of that?
A victim of that,
yeah.
Those circumstances that
yeah.
are increasing. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, it's like it all started with Reagan. That's got to be the title of one of my books. I'm telling you, someday.
I'm also wondering about this gerrymandering.
Yeah.
When, where, and why did this voter party registration come into being? I mean, couldn't we defeat gerrymandering by just everybody registering Republican or something, whether you're going to vote Democrat or whatever?
Well, the problem is in a closed primary state, if you do that, you can't vote in the primary unless you're registered for that party.
But you could vote for the worst possible candidate on the opposing party.
You could. You could, but you might end up with that person. I remember back in 1980 when there were people going, oh, yeah, let's make sure Ronald Reagan's the Republican candidate. Nobody in their right mind would vote for him.
Just a couple of thoughts.
Yeah, but interesting. Now, I think that we need to have a constitutional amendment. This is one of those things, the whole gerrymandering thing. It's one of those things that the founders and framers, I don't think they even imagined that politicians, the political parties would emerge. I mean, at that point in time, there were no political parties. The political parties would emerge and would become so toxic and so self-centered and put themselves so ahead of the interests of the United States of America and of small-d democracy and our republic that they would gerrymander the way that we have been seen, particularly in the last couple of decades. It is mind-boggling. And I think because the framers of the Constitution, the people who wrote the Constitution, that was an oversight on their part that, you know, they didn't specify, they didn't give any greater level of detail to how redistricting has to be done as population changes with the census every 10 years, that it's time to amend the Constitution to say that congressional districts have to be polygons or congressional districts are drawn by, you know, by somebody who has no dog in the fight, although that's damn hard to come up with. You know, you get people who say, oh, I'm nonpartisan. Yeah, right. You know, it's increasingly our judges now are being elected by billionaires, you know, so that when their businesses come before them, they're going to have a good hearing or, you know, by political parties. So it's a tough one. That's why I think that's something for a constitutional amendment. Jerry, thank you for the call. Excellent point. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, United Arab Emirates.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I found out recently when investigating a job possibility in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, that I'm too old at 57 to apply for their jobs because they have a mandatory retirement age of 60, and it's just that's what they have across the in Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates. And I think it's kind of interesting because my father actually retired at 62. But most likely I will not be able to retire until I'm like 66 or 67 because I will not be able to get my full Social Security until then. And, you know, the retirement age seems to be increasing in the Western world, but I thought that was a pretty nice benefit, and it's mandatory apparently in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and if you want to see unemployment go down, and if you want to see young people get into the workplace with, you know, better and better paychecks, then simply drop the age at which people qualify for Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits. Drop it down to 60 or even drop it to 55. If we dropped it to 55, probably half, maybe as many as three quarters of the people between 55 and 65 would choose to continue working. You know,
right.
I would think probably half of them anyway. But the half that chooses to retire by recusing themselves from the workforce, by withdrawing themselves from the workforce, what they're doing is they're freeing up jobs. They're opening up jobs for young people to step into, and it would be a huge boon for our economy. And
yeah.
That would then, you know, tighten up the labor market, which would drive up wages. As wages go up, as unemployment goes down, then the two things that you see as a consequence, the main thing that you see as a consequence of that is increased tax collections. Those increased mm-hmm. tax collections will pay for the cost of those people retiring. You do the math on this, and it actually works somewhere between 55 and 60.
I just wanted to say I work in a profession that is incredibly stressful. It's both physically and intellectually demanding, and to continue to work, I mean, I may not be able to work that long.
Yeah.
But there's no like safety net as far as like I won't be able to get insurance. And you know, I've lost so much money in the stock market because, as you said, Ronald Reagan and a lot of others have pushed to get rid of pension plans. So I no longer get a pension plan, but a 401k.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I'm not complaining in the sense that there are a lot of other people in the same position, but
we should all be complaining.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there should be a national pension plan that's an actual national pension plan. You know, when my dad retired, back in the late 90s, which mm-hmm. wasn't that long ago, he right. actually planned on living on Social Security. Now, he
right.
had, by that point in time, he had paid off his house, he had paid off his car, he was completely debt-free because he worked in a union shop for 40 years, and,
right.
you know, so and he could, you know. Well, he also had a pension. He had a pension from Metal Machining Company. And
right.
I guess between that and Social Security, he was going to do just fine, you know, had he not paid off.
I mean, I just don't understand that in other countries that are not nearly as wealthy as we are in Western Europe, that they are able to provide, you know, either it's like two-thirds or three-quarters of your salary for the rest of your life, and people get nationalized health care, and we can't do that here. I mean, simply because, you know, certain people decided for us that wasn't a good deal. And it's like, well,
right.
of course it's a good deal. Why not, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just ridiculous that we're the wealthiest country still on the face of the earth, and we can't provide that for our own citizens. It's just not civilized. Even
yeah.
Saudi Arabia sees the value of retiring people at 60 if they want, you know, they want
yeah.
to. I mean,
let's attend to our language here, John. You said we're the wealthiest country in the world and we can't provide that to our citizens. We can. We choose not to.
Yeah, and I just don't understand that. It would be very popular with most
people. Of course,
yeah.
But the Republicans will never let it pass because the billionaires, you know, they have hoarding syndrome. I am convinced that the people who are funding the Republican Party and some parts of the Democratic Party, but certainly virtually
right.
the entire Republican Party, the people funding it, the billionaires funding it, have hoarding syndrome. That if instead of being born, you know, with Daddy Coke giving you, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, you know, upon birth or upon his death or whatever, instead of that, if they had been born into a trailer park or into Appalachia or something like that, they would be one of the people that would, you know, the camera crews would be coming out for the hoarding reality show where the house is filled with newspapers up to the ceiling and you've got to walk through narrow paths and they've got balls of string and old tin cans and all that kind of stuff, because they have hoarding syndrome. Only the object of their hoarding is not newspapers or tin cans or cats. It is money. And, you know, this is, you know, nobillionaires.com. It's like we've got enough billionaires already. And I think personally, I think that anybody with wealth over $999,999,099, the additional wealth should be taxed at 100%. That if you can't live on $1 billion, then society has a problem, actually. John, thank you for the call. Society has a problem. I mean, we have to face this. This is a cultural problem here in the United States.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And a large part of it goes back to, I mean, before Reagan, the American dream was my dad's life. And after Reagan, it was the lottery. Hey, I'm going to become a billionaire. Really? Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour. And Ted in Palos Hills, Illinois. Hey, Ted, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Tom, hi. You know what? I was going to say something about Detroit, but I was just listening to you right now. You know, a lot of conservatives like to make that hollow argument as far as Chicago goes. Oh, Chicago has very strict gun laws. Why is there so much crime? But, you know, it's just like you said, the root cause of it is essentially ignored. Because it makes it seem like gun control here is not doing anything, but if you take away the gun control that we do have, okay, the crime rate is going to be much higher. Okay, so it's a hollow argument because it's proportionate. And the reason why is because of poverty.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's essentially what's happening. You know, it's, the crime rate in the rural areas is not as high, Okay, but, you know, it's likely that if you take away the gun control there, it's going to go up too. But if there's no gun control across the plain, then there's gun violence is going to be higher in the urban areas than it's going to be in the rural areas, you know. So it's a hollow argument, you know, but that's like willfully ignored, you know, when they say that, oh, it's not working in Chicago. Well, it is working. It would be a lot worse. It would be, a lot worse than what it even is right now. So.
Yeah, the argument that they're making is, let me read you a paragraph long, well, it's two sentences. It's a paragraph from a 1985. Now, just step into the Wayback Machine for a minute and go back to 1985. And Ronald Reagan is president. He's just, you know, he's, let's see, 80, 84. Yeah, he's just been reelected president. And he is dismantling the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson's programs, anti-poverty programs. And here's what the New York Times says, because what you're saying is, you know, hey, if we, you know, our crime rate would be far worse, or our gun violence rate in Chicago would be far worse if we did away with our gun control laws. So they're doing some good. Why get rid of them? Here we are, 1985. Some of the peripheral Great Society programs President Reagan wants to abolish this year have worked so well in his administration's view that they're no longer needed. For example, there is now a surplus rather than a shortage of doctors and dentists in our country, and therefore the Reagan administration argues that the government no longer should subsidize the training of healthcare professionals. So, you know, hey, the program's working. Let's scrap it. And you're saying essentially the same thing about, you know, that's what conservatives are calling for with gun control. Do I have that right, Ted?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. Okay. Interesting. This appears to be a longstanding conservative talking point. Hey, it works great. Let's get rid of it. Thanks for the call, Ted. John in Chicago. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
I wanted to make a comment on the odor of protection.
Mm-hmm.
I went through a nasty divorce, and although I had never done anything to my ex physically, and she had to me, and there was documentation of that, she put an order of protection on me.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so I can't exactly see an order of protection being somebody in somebody's background that gives you a real insight as to what they're like.
Okay. I'll withdraw that suggestion, and let's go back to the way that I think the law is, that somebody actually has to be convicted of a violent crime before they can't pass a background check. That makes sense. John, thank you for sharing that. Good point. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. We were talking about gerrymandering earlier.
Yeah.
California had that problem. And what we did was we passed a law saying all our congressional districts had to be done by a bipartisan party. And it worked perfect for us. Our state house is back to being a democratically controlled state house. It reflects the population of our state.
Mm-hmm.
Accurately. And we've been fixing all kinds of serious problems we've had in California are now being fixed because our government is working. People want government to work. And if,
excellent suggestion.
Democratic, and they do it for Republicans, and the only reason why they won was gerrymandering. We got to get a national law saying that's it.
Yeah. Now, how does Paul, if you've got a state that is already heavily gerrymandered by Republicans and now it takes a bipartisan commission to change it, doesn't that just freeze it in place?
Well, no, because your bipartisan committee would switch it. It would change it immediately.
Well, why would the Republicans on that committee vote to change the congressional districts that are working to their favor?
Well, all I know is it worked perfect here in California, and I got a new congressman out of it, and it really works out well. And a bipartisan committee, you have to make sure the committee is bipartisan.
Yeah.
You can't have it be loaded with Democratic, with people that are going to only be for Democrats, and you got to have a bipartisan committee that works well together. That's the key.
Right.
And there is enough people out there in this country that can do it. We have plenty of people with integrity still that could do this.
No, I don't disagree. I don't disagree, Paul. I'm getting increasingly cynical about the political process. But this is why I think, you know, if we were to add that all districts must be polygons, you know, that they must be, you know, a continuous geometric shape that as close as possible resembles something between a circle and a square, you know, that would work better. You know, no more of these, hey, let's go 5 miles away and just, you know, run one street down there to grab, you know, 5,000 people over there. Have you seen, has California, have the congressional districts in California started to assume more rational geometric shapes?
Yes, they have, and we've got more, since the census went up, we got more representatives now and stuff like that.
Yeah.
In my area, it now has a representative that is very, I live in a really rural, poor area. I live in one of the poorest areas in California. And our congressman came here to have a town hall meeting. He's called me on the phone and had a national, a massive town hall meeting on cell phones and stuff.
Right.
The guy is really, really showing me that government can still work if we just put the right people there.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. If you just put the right people there, and that's the key. And also you have to change the rules of the game, and that's what redistricting or creating a bipartisan commission for redistricting in California has done. Thanks, Paul. That's a little bit of brightness in a otherwise somewhat foggy day. Much appreciate the call and the information. We will be back. We're going to be talking about the Newt. No, I'm not from Canada. How do we handle congressmen like John Boehner who get rich off things like the Keystone XL pipeline?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Well, we have this interesting spectacle where John Boehner is invested in at least seven companies that will see their stock go up and see his wealth go up if the Keystone XL pipeline is approved. Why is that an okay thing in American politics? Brian Baird, Congressman Brian Baird of Washington State, discovered Tom DeLay's office, this was back some years ago, that they were day trading in the back room because Congress had carved out an exception for itself, and they can trade on inside information, members of Congress and their staff members, and without any penalties. And so they were doing it. And then he discovered a whole bunch of other Republican members of the House of Representatives, took it to Nancy Pelosi. She had literally had no idea, was horrified. Brought this to the floor and spoke about it. They passed a law to put an end to it. It got out of the House of Representatives. It was passed when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House and got over to the Senate, and it was filibustered by the Republicans. Why is this a partisan issue? Bradley Smith is with us, chairman and co-founder of the Center for Competitive Politics, former chairman of the Federal Election Commission. Campaignfreedom.org is the website. Bradley, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Jim. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. It's Tom, but I'll take it.
It's funny because one thing, I appreciate the fact that as I've told you before, you're one of my favorite guys because you actually have different views on and treat them well, so I like it.
Well, thank you. I know that the Center for Competitive Politics, you know, one of the things, for example, that we disagree on is you think corporations should have the constitutional right of free speech to engage in political action because they're aggregations of persons, for example, and I disagree with that. And we'll, you know, we can just leave that where it is. But why would we disagree on this?
Well, I don't know that we disagree except for, you know, maybe some disagreement on particulars. For example, to be honest, I'm not really familiar with what was in the bill that was passed by the House and blocked.
It simply said that the standards for insider trading, the insider trading laws, that those standards, that there is no longer a congressional exemption from those standards. And the objection by the Republicans was that we handle so much business and so many things that we would have to put, you know, pretty much all of us would have to put our money in blind trusts, which sounds reasonable to me. I mean, that's how it used to be. That's what, you know, Dwight Eisenhower did.
Yeah, I don't think that that's necessarily a problem. In other words, if people want to go to blind trust, personally, I don't particularly have a problem with that. I think it's probably a good thing. What I would point out is that this is something that is sort of endemic to modern Congress, that that when they say, oh, we have our hands in so many things, you know, we always have conflicts of interest. In a sense, that's right. And it's one of the costs, I think, that goes with, you know, large government. I mean, you run into problems, you're going to start requiring, you know, every staffer in Congress to do every investment, and, you know, it becomes very, very difficult for people to survive in that kind of environment.
Okay, so,
you know, my view is that Congress should be tighter about saying you're going to put your assets in blind trust. I think Congress should also be tighter about what spouses are doing. That is, mm-hmm. you know, we've had many cases where spouses of prominent congressmen and senators are actually lobbyists and going around lobbying. Well, you know, I'm just doing this on my own. Totally, you know, nobody knows my spouse is, you know, a very powerful senator. I don't think that that should be tolerated either. But I point out that this is not a partisan issue either, in the sense of who's doing it. I mean, you know, you have people like Dianne Feinstein, whose husband has enormous contracts with the federal government. You have folks all through government who have, you know, spouses who are working with government cases. When Tom Daschle was Senate Majority Leader, his wife was one of those people who was a lobbyist.
Yeah, and I can give you a list of Republicans who have done the same thing. If Phil Graham's wife, Wendy, was on the board of Enron, which is why we got the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and Graham Leach Bliley, which blew up Glass-Steagall and led right to the crash, you know, and created a $700 trillion, you know, gray market for commodities that never existed before 1999.
Well, you said so much in there, I couldn't say that that's right. But I would have said that's right if you'd stopped just after, yeah, this is a Republican thing, too, and use Wendy Graham as an example.
Sure. Okay. But here's the you say it's because of big government. Government as a percentage of GDP in the United States is more or less 20%. I mean, our government spends a little over 20%, brings in a little under 20%, but it's roughly a fifth of our economy. It's more like 40% in Canada. It's well over 40% in most European countries. It's in the neighborhood of 50% in most of them. So if big government is the problem, why is it that we have this problem of corrupted politicians, and by and large those countries don't?
I would disagree with that supposition. I think if you look at most of those countries, if anything, the problem is worse, and it's so bad that people don't even think twice about it. The entwining of government and business in countries like France and much of Europe and Italy and so on is just astronomically bad. And again,
well, you know, Italy, I'll give you. I think Berlusconi is a case in point.
This is a case in which, you know, it's not to me. Let's put it this way. As I say, I think in the end, this is a side effect of big government. That is not, per se, an argument that we shouldn't have big government, right? I mean, there are downsides to having small government as well.
Well, isn't it an argument not
those are going to be there?
Yeah, isn't it an argument not for big or small government, but for an argument for ethical government? That if somebody wants to, you know, serve the goddess, you know, the goddess of democracy, Columbia, if they want to come to the District of Columbia and serve the public, that that there's a certain price to pay for that. You have to give up self, you know, aggrandizement and self-wealth. I mean, you know, Alison Grimes, who's going to be running against Mitch McConnell, just released an ad that basically raises the question, how is it that Mitch McConnell went off to Washington, D.C., not a millionaire, and is now a multimillionaire, and he gets a $160,000 a year salary? How'd that happen?
Well, we're going to find that from an awful lot of people Washington, D.C. And I think that you're right. I think this is part of the long-term dissatisfaction with D.C. is this feeling that they operate as a separate, you know, kind of group from the rest of us.
Yep.
When I was at the FEC, you know, again, I was quite deregulatory generally, but one area where I was very tough was on the idea, again, of using campaign funds for personal use, that campaign funds had to be spent on a campaign. And I think, you know, I used to say the same thing about the type of relationships we're talking about here. People would say, well, for example, why should my spouse have to give up his or her, you know, business investments simply because I'm in the Senate? My response is, well, why should other Americans have to give up their speech rights simply because you're in the Senate? You know,
right.
If we're worried about corruption, let's put it on those members of Congress who are there. So I think that, you know, you let off the segment by talking about the Keystone Pipeline. Again, that's not something where I can say that I know, you know, the details about John Boehner's investments or anything else. The story's been out there for a long time. I presume that he has not violated any House or Senate rules. Or
no, it's not against the law what he's doing. In fact, it's something that pretty much, well, I actually have no idea what percentage of members of Congress do it. But it
The big thing is that this is a bipartisan problem, and we should put tougher restrictions, I think, on members of Congress. But at some level, we are going to run into the problem that, you know, there's an awful lot of people working up there now, and you've got all the folks in state government, and we have issues of you know, just the connections people have with lobbyists and their hopes to get future jobs and future things to do. And I think when we look at all that, we also need to recognize that we shouldn't be too horribly cynical. That is, you know, pretty much every Republican supports the Keystone Pipeline. I don't think you find very many that oppose it. I don't think there's any reason to believe that most of them think that the pipeline is a bad idea. I think most of them think it is a good idea and would support it anyway.
Yeah.
So it's very tough to disentangle, again, you know, why people are acting in particular situations.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. And what it does is it just takes us back to the more abstract issue, or the more solid issue, actually, of, you know, what do we do about what appears to be corruption in government? Bradley Smith, chairman and co-founder of the Center for Competitive Politics, campaignfreedom.org, the website. Thank you, Bradley.
Thanks.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we fix our Democratic Republic? I think we amend the Constitution to say corporations aren't people and money ain't free speech. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. You know, back in 1980, so much began in that year. It's just incredible. Back in 1980, the Reagan campaign and the Republican Party made a deal with the guys who led the Christian right movement in America. Republican officials sat down with the likes of Jerry Falwell, Ralph Reed, Pat Robertson, and made a deal. The deal was about mutual support. The Republican Party would support the Christian right, its teachings, and its messages. And if they got control of the government, they'd transfer hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer funds to Christian efforts, ranging from Christian schools to outreach centers operating under the guise of sex education programs, soup kitchens, and shelters. In exchange, the Christian right would support the economic and political goals of the Republican Party. And ever since that deal was done, the Republican Party has been positioning themselves as the Christian Party and the Party of God. Sort of like the Taliban. And then things got really odd. Ronald Reagan, the Messiah of the Republican Party, almost never went to church and launched a war called Reaganomics on poor and working people while vastly enriching the already rich. And George W. Bush, whose presidency ushered in a second wave of Republican religiosity in America, and who once said that he had made the decision to commit my heart to Jesus Christ, went on to kill hundreds of thousands in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is the same George W. Bush who also told Palestinian leaders in 2003 that, quote, I'm driven with a mission from God. God would tell me, George, go and fight those terrorists in Afghanistan, and I did. And God would tell me, George, go and end the tyranny in Iraq, and I did. End of quote. Yes, that's an actual quote from George W. Bush. This is not Christian behavior by pretty much any metric. In Matthew 25, Jesus was very specific about what it means to be a Christian. He says, for I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. By that criteria, the Republican Party is not a party that Jesus would recognize. For example, earlier this month, Republicans voted to cut billions in spending from the SNAP food programs, the food stamp programs over 10 years, and nearly 3 million Americans would have lost food assistance next year as a result. Meanwhile, Republicans have repeatedly filibustered or blocked legislation to help homeless veterans, have tried to cut programs like Section 8 housing, which provide affordable housing to low-income residents, and have cut funding to homeless shelters nationwide. Just last year, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Congressman Paul Ryan's Republican austerity budget would have taken away housing assistance from nearly a million American households. Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says that Republican-driven sequesters well, the Republican-driven sequester, has pushed as many as 140,000 American households into homelessness. And while Republicans refuse to address the epidemic of homelessness in America, they're also refusing to address the issue of health care in this country. You know, Obamacare was passed so that more Americans could have access to health care. You know, hey, I'm sick. I need help. Okay, sure. No problem. Basic human cost. What have the Republicans done? 39 times now they've voted to repeal it, and never once have they offered an alternative. They're also working to slash funding to social safety net programs like Medicare and Medicaid, which keep millions of low-income and elderly Americans alive. The Republican Party says it's pro-life, but waging endless wars, refusing to back background checks to keep violent people from buying guns, and taking away health care from millions of Americans shows that they lie. And then there's the absurd claim Republicans make about being against abortion. In reality, Republican-backed policies are increasing the number of abortions in America. Republicans love to push abstinence-only sex education, but the only measurable thing that an abstinence-only education does is increase the number of unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases. The Republican Party also claims it's pro-family, but again, throwing Americans onto the street, slashing unemployment benefits, devastating programs like SNAP and Medicaid, all prove otherwise. In Matthew 6:24, the New Testament, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve both God and money." It's pretty clear that Republicans are doing very little to serve God and a whole lot to serve money. So, my suggestion, if Republicans want to go down the Christian road, instead of listening to hustlers like Ralph Reed and Pat Robertson, they could start by listening to Pope Francis. Pope Francis, the leader of the Catholic Church, the largest sect of Christianity in the world, has repeatedly denounced the very ideas that today's Republican Party promotes. In May, this Pope of the Poor lashed out against predatory capitalism, saying that, quote, quoting the Pope, "Unbridled capitalism has taught the logic of profit at any cost, of giving in order to receive, of exploitation without looking at the person." Back in July, he said that the global community must, quote, "fight against wild capitalism and confront social injustice," end quote. Pope Francis is even concerned about the environment, something Republicans brag about trashing and exploiting. During his trip to Brazil this past week, Pope Francis called for, quote, "respect and protection of the entire creation which God has entrusted to man, not so that it can be indiscriminately exploited, but rather made into a garden." The Pope preaches tolerance, something the very intolerant Republican Party could learn about. Just this morning, the Pope told reporters that, quote, "if someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to judge?" So if Republicans really want to keep calling themselves Christians, if they want to continue waving that flag and saying, "oh yeah, we're the party of the Christians," at the very least, they should start listening to the Pope. Not that he speaks for all Christians, but I mean, it's like over a billion Christians. They should start listening to this guy and change their policies to reflect the basic tenets of Christianity. And, you know, that guy who started it, Jesus. Okay, end of sermon. But, you know, something just doesn't add up here. And the Pope is making it so clear that, you know, how somebody who really, really follows Christianity would behave and would speak relative to how the Republican Party does. It's so clear.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You know, I thought J2P2 was a pretty good pope. I thought Benedict was a little odd. This guy, Francis, that's a good pope. Yes, the Pope has a lesson for the Republicans. And gerrymandering is good for you. And John Boehner is going to get rich at the Keystone Pipeline. Well, he's already rich. What can you say? Pam in Long Beach, California. Hey, Pam, what's on your mind today?
You were talking to someone earlier about California's getting away with gerrymandering.
Mm-hmm.
Or getting away from gerrymandering.
Right, right.
what we did out here was we passed a proposition, and the proposition created a panel to draw the districts.
Right.
And the panel was made up of 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 independents. And if you were an independent and wanted to be on the panel, you submitted your name.
Right.
Anyway, they came up with 5 people, or 15 people, and they worked and they got a map. And then they took the map on tour around the state to get comments on it. And then they finalized it, and that's what we ended up using. The Republicans were extremely unhappy. They sued. And I, for the life of me, I cannot remember why they dropped the suit, but it was right before the election.
Mm-hmm.
It had already, the redistricting had already been done.
Right.
And they dropped the suit. And now California is getting stuff done.
Yeah.
Because we don't have these idiots in the legislature who don't want anything.
Yeah.
If it takes
a majority, then those 5 independents, 3 of those 5 independents would be the swing vote, basically. And
that's right.
And so I
live in Long Beach, a city of almost 500,000 people, and we were carved up into 3 separate congressional districts.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're one.
Which makes sense.
Some areas around us, but now we're one. And I have a congressman who I like.
Yeah.
As opposed to Dana Rohrabacher, who I could not stand.
Yeah, he was an odd duck. He was a genuinely odd duck. Okay, so thank you, Pam. Thanks for clarifying, because that was the piece, you know, when the previous caller said, well, we have this bipartisan commission. And I was thinking, okay, 50-50, that, you know, welcome to the Senate. I mean, you know, it's like a prescription for gridlock. But that makes sense. Thank you very much for filling that in for me. I appreciate it. Wyatt in Steilacoom, Washington. Hey, Wyatt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm operating with a little older information, but I haven't seen anything that changes that. I was an elected official in rural America for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And statistics from the Census Board, the Demographic Graphics of America, published in about 1985, said the rural American was the highest in all the bad statistics. Poverty, abuse, crime, and violent crime.
Yeah, there's a meth epidemic, for example, going on right now in rural America.
There's what?
A methamphetamine epidemic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Frank.
And everyone has a gun.
Yeah.
Back then they had the rifle in the rack of the back of their pickup truck.
Yep.
They're hiding them now. You don't see the rifle racks that much. One of the most shocking statistics in that was that a young male in rural America, rural is this, defined as less than 50 people per square mile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's behind all those little villages and towns you see when you drive the blue highways. A young male in rural America was 11 times more likely to die a violent death than in the worst ghetto in the United States. So I think the myth the man's dealing with, and a lot of people deal with in their lives, is a myth.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So violence on a per capita rather than a per square mile basis might actually, you're asserting it's actually an order of magnitude higher in rural America than it is in urban America.
Yeah, and that's per capita.
Yeah.
The rural, you know, the different middle, you know, different districts are defined per capita.
Right. Right.
And I just see nothing that has changed that. I've cut all my rural buddies off my Facebook. Just because I can't stand the endless chatter about guns.
Yeah.
And they're not, what they're saying now is what they were saying back in third grade on the playground.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a variation on the same one. Wyatt, thank you for calling and sharing that observation with us. I'm going to have to look into that. That's very, very interesting. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just read recently that the from the 1990s, the elite described us as the working class as useless eaters in the future. And that what's going to happen was they're just going to have massive unemployment. And the sense that, you know, this is going to take place, it's now become clear to me, is that the media will only reflect what the, the people who are employed, who are watching that, who people who can buy things, appeals to clients. And what it's become clear to me is that we are heading towards like a Koch brothers idea of a society where, you know, people are considered useless eaters. And it just bothers the hell out of me. And I have no idea, like when you say, say something hopeful or perspectives, but I, the only thing I can think of is that everybody just put down their back feet and stand up and say, we're not going to take this anymore.
Yeah.
Demand Congress, demand somebody, or go down there and tell those people to say, be, you know,
well, over 500 communities and, about a dozen states now have basically done that, Frank. They have passed, ordinances or resolutions going along with the, moveToAmend.org folks to say corporations are not people and billionaires' money is not free speech. And, enough is enough already. We want to amend the Constitution to say that. And I think that is the uprising, and I agree with you that the super rich want to destroy the middle class. It makes for a more subservient class. I was having this conversation the other day actually last night with a friend of mine and a couple of friends of ours were over, and the issue came up of why aren't kids in the streets? And, in the 60s, kids were in the streets over issues that impacted them, specifically the Vietnam War. You know, why aren't they in the streets over $1 trillion in credit card debt? Well, because they're in chains. Debt is a form of servitude. I mean, there were two principal forms of slavery in the United States at the founding of this republic. One was, the race-based, bring them over from Africa and put them to work in the plantation slavery. Identifying a group of people and saying, okay, those people are going to be these slaves. But then there was a second one where the slaves were actually indentured servants. And if they were indentured for life, and many of them were, they were slaves as well, functionally. Or they were slaves for a limited period of time. And these were principally white Europeans. And Americans would bring them over, and say, okay, I will pay for the cost of their transportation to come over here from Ireland or Italy or something like that for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years worth of work. And they are my indentured servants. And what we have now is in our prisons, we have the involuntary form of slavery once again. And once again, it's becoming highly racially biased. And then in our, among our students, our graduating students, college students, we have indentured servitude. And those indentured servants, did not rise up. I mean, they didn't get that this was a bad deal, or they got that it was a bad deal, but they didn't feel like they had the power to do anything about it. And the law was against them. And it is again. Yeah.
In the idea of the way they're cementing this thing over it, is with the media. You look at any of the media now, it's all a reflection of them. I remember in the 60s, I used to read the Boston Globe editorial page, and so I realized these people aren't talking to me. They're talking to other editorial writers. That's who they're appealing to. And they're not talking to me, and that's the way the present-day media is. If you reflect the image that you want to think that Americans want to think of themselves as, then it will suffice for a season or two, but it will keep them going. But the ultimate thing was they think of us as useless eaters. Now, I cannot in the life of me think of anything more gross than some people, other people thinking of someone else as that.
Yeah. Well, it's neo-Calvinism, Frank. You know, it's the Calvinistic notion that, you know, there are a few good people among us, and God identifies them for us by making them rich. And therefore, we should basically bow down to them, and we should protect them and protect their riches and protect their privileges and their perks. And that's the job of the Republican Party. And it's just, it's a grim, grim, tragic reality. Frank, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service and more of your calls here on Anything Goes Summer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And now this group is going to send George Zimmerman $12,000 to buy guns. You know, I think this is just a fundraising hustle for this group. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Where you can receive a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan. Victoria, hey.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
Well, PFC Bradley Manning could learn as early as tomorrow afternoon whether he will be convicted of aiding the enemy, which is punishable by life in prison without parole, for sending more than 700,000 government documents to anti-secrecy website WikiLeaks.
Wow.
Colonel Denise Lind, who is the judge in the case, has said that she will issue her decision at 1 p.m. Eastern tomorrow afternoon.
So he is not being judged by a jury. He's being judged by a judge?
That was his choice.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
He didn't want a jury of his peers.
Okay.
So we'll find out. And then she's scheduled tentatively a sentencing hearing beginning Wednesday.
Okay.
So she's not messing about.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently not. Well, it'll be, I guess, good to have this over, although there will no doubt be appeals. But it'll be interesting to find out what's going on.
Yes, indeed. Peace talks, or at least talks about peace talks, are scheduled to start tonight and continue through Tuesday between the Israelis and the Palestinians for the first time since 2010 in Washington, D.C., President Obama heralded them as a promising step forward today in a statement, but he's also said the most difficult work of these negotiations is ahead, and I'm hopeful that both the Israelis and Palestinians will approach these talks in good faith and with sustained focus and determination, saying that the U.S. stands ready to support them throughout the negotiation with the goal of achieving two states living side by side in peace and security. Also said he was pleased by the appointment of Martin Indyk, who served as President Clinton's ambassador to Israel, as the U.S. special envoy for the talks. I have to tell you that just by perusing the some of the Middle Eastern papers, the English editions, there's enormous skepticism about the future of these talks.
Well, with good reason. I mean, we've been through this going all the way back to the Eisenhower administration.
Yes.
But that said, hope springs eternal.
Indeed, and must.
Yes.
And I imagine you've already been talking about this, but the strikes involving thousands of fast food workers across seven cities launched today in what organizers said could be the biggest labor action in the industry's history.
Yes, we actually haven't. And in fact, I should have gotten somebody on from that strike for the show today. We will look into that tomorrow. But so tell us about it.
Well, hundreds kicked off the demonstrations in New York City with workers starting a 24-hour strike demanding a base wage of $15 per hour and the right to form a union. And then over the next 4 days, similar strikes will occur in St. Louis, Chicago, Detroit, and Milwaukee, as well as Flint, Michigan, and Kansas City, Missouri.
What union or unions are involved in helping this happen?
Well, it's not clear to me what union it is that's helping them, but certainly the Congressional Progressive Caucus has got involved in helping them. There are groups that are helping them, but the stories that I have seen, and I have had to seek out these stories doing Google searches. because they don't show up on the front page of any of the news sites, which is interesting.
So there's kind of a news blackout on these strikes.
It's like they're not they're just not considered major news.
Wow.
It's very, very interesting. So I have not seen which unions are supporting them. I'm sure there are unions supporting them. I just have not seen which ones there are. I'm sure that's very findable.
Yeah. Okay.
Pope Francis reached out to gays today.
Yes.
In a very wide-ranging, apparently funny and candid interview that he gave at a news conference, actually, on board the plane coming back from Brazil, in which he didn't dodge any questions. Took everything.
Wow.
He said, if someone is gay and he searches for the Lord and has goodwill, who am I to dodge?
That is a profoundly Christian thing to say.
Indeed.
I did a little rant about that about 30 minutes ago, 40 minutes ago, suggesting that the Republican Party should be listening to the Pope if they want to continue calling themselves the Party of American Christianity. You know,
he said some other interesting things. He also talked about the reports that a trusted aide was involved in an alleged gay tryst a decade ago, saying he investigated the allegations according to canon law, found nothing to back them up. And he took journalists to task for reporting on the matter, saying the allegations concern matters of sin, not crimes like sexually abusing children. And when someone sins and confesses, he said, God not only forgives but forgets. We don't have the right to not forget, he said.
Hmm.
This is an interesting way of looking at things, I think.
Yeah.
He also spoke about the role of women in the church. He didn't, of course, go all the way. But he did say in Rio that he described the church in feminine terms, saying it would be sterile without women, which is a very interesting term to use. Asked what role he foresaw, he said the church must develop a more profound role for women in the church.
That's marvelous. Yeah, you know, I doubt we'll see women as priests in my lifetime, but
he said the door is closed to that.
Yeah. But I suspect that as time moves along, we will see that. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
And your final story is the Government Accountability Office said today that the Agriculture Department might be sending millions of dollars in subsidies to dead farmers.
Really?
Yes.
And who's cashing the checks?
Well, not clear. Somebody is. They looked at crop insurance data from 2008 to 2012 and found that $22 million in subsidies and allowances may have been provided on behalf of an estimated 3,434 program policyholders 2 or more years after death.
I think we have found Ronald Reagan's welfare queen.
There you go.
Remarkable. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking. We'll be back. Anything goes summer here on the Tom Harbin program. I'll fill you in on the union story here with a little more detail there.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our show. We are now up to 9 cities where fast food workers, who typically earn $7 to $9 an hour, are saying no. No, thank you. Well, actually, they're saying, yes, I'll keep the job, but for a day, I'm going to go out and strike. I'm going to step off the job here. They're calling for a $15 hourly wage. This is for pretty tough work. Working with hot grease, working with cranky people, working standing on your feet, having to eat this stuff because it's there. Oh, I'm going for lunch. Where are you going? I think I'll go someplace else. No, you can't do that. So anyhow, today at 3 o'clock, when this show first went on the air, Manhattan in New York City, in Union Square they were meeting. And then there were also walkouts on Monday in Kansas City and St. Louis. And over the next few days, according to the activists who are putting this thing together, and there's a wide variety of them, we will see the same thing happening in Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee, Flint, and Seattle's already done it. They're expected to repeat it. And Washington, D.C. has had three separate strikes so far this year. This is pretty impressive. I mean, when you've got the President of the United States calling for a $9 an hour minimum wage, federal minimum wage right now is $7.25. It would be $10.20 an hour if it was simply where it was in 1968. When the economy was doing very well, thank you very much. But the President is saying, hey, you know, how about just $9? And Republicans are saying, how about zero? No, I'm serious. I'm not making that up. I'm serious. There's a whole substantial contingent in the Republican Party who are saying, oh, yeah, the minimum wage, that should be at zero. We don't need no stinking minimum wage, these Republicans are saying. You know, it's like, you know, why should a company have to pay? Here's the rationale. If you have a minimum wage, then it's not possible. Let me rephrase this. There are some business activities which are so marginally profitable that they can really only afford to pay $2 or $3 an hour. Why should those businesses not be able to exist? Or there are some business owners who are so greedy that they only want to pay $2 or $3 an hour. And by the way, at the same time, there are people in some cities who are willing to work for $2 or $3 an hour. And in fact, the fact of the matter is there's people actually right now, right this minute, all across America who are working for $2 or $3 an hour. A lot of restaurants pay $2 an hour plus tips. A little bit over $2 an hour. But then you've got agricultural workers. You've got people working out in the fields, which is some of the, you know, hardest, most backbreaking work, where they're making $3 an hour or less. So this is, I mean, you know, this is not just, you know, some kind of theoretical thing. This is actually going on. I mean, there's people being paid very, very little. And we've, as a society, we've kind of said, okay, well, you know, the people working in the fields and the maids and, like, you know, we'll pay them less. Which I have a problem with. People say, well, you know, your food is going to cost more. It's not going to cost that much more. Remember when John McCain was talking about you shouldn't raise the minimum wage up to the minimum wage for agricultural workers in Arizona, because nobody would come pick our lettuce, John McCain said. And, you know, it turns out that, in fact, McCain said, you know, I don't think anybody would do it for $50 an hour. Thousands of people sent him, you know, I'll do it for $50 an hour. So it's not a question of, you know, are you willing to pick lettuce? It's are you willing to pick lettuce for $3 an hour? I don't think there's any shortage of people in this country who would pick lettuce for $10 an hour. And the basis for my saying that is the conversations that I had with Dennis Weaver when he was still alive. The guy who used to play in Gunsmoke, you know, he was Chester in Gunsmoke and played Sam McCloud, the TV series, and Dennis Weaver was a good guy. He was a friend. I wrote the foreword to his autobiography, which is called All the World's a Stage. And he invented this thing called Econonomics, which was the merger of economics and ecology. It's a brilliant idea. And around the time he died, we were working on trying to figure out how to make it go farther. You know, there were a couple of universities that were picking it up and teaching it. But anyhow, Dennis Weaver told me the story, and he tells it in his book, The Whole World's a Stage, his autobiography, with an introduction by Tom Hartman. He tells this story of how when he was a kid, it was during the Great Depression, during the Dust Bowl days, and his father had left the family, and his mom took him and his sister and I think a brother, I think there were three of them, and put him in the station wagon and drove from the panhandle of Texas, as I recall, up to the central Washington state, and they picked strawberries. They were migrant farm workers, and they worked their way down the coast as the season expanded, you know, being migrant farm workers, working for what in today's dollars would probably be, you know, $5, $6 an hour. So anyhow, the Republican argument is that by having a minimum wage, you're eliminating the ability to have these entry-level jobs, and you're cutting people out of the workforce, blah, 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 blah. And my response to that is, number one, there is no empirical evidence to support that. When the minimum wage was put into place in the 1930s, it did not increase unemployment. It reduced it. It was a stimulus to the economy because minimum wage workers spend 100% of the money they earn, as opposed to Mitt Romney-level workers who save most of what they earn. And when you spend 100% of what you earn, you are stimulating the economy. The job creators are the bottom 50% of Americans in terms of income. They're the real job creators. They're the ones creating demand. Arguably, the bottom 80% of Americans. It's probably the bottom 80% are spending everything they get. And secondly, business is a privilege in this country. There's nothing in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that says you have the right to own a business. If you want to own a business, if you want to conduct business, and you want certain tax advantages, and you want limitations of liability, and you want all the benefits that come with a corporation, with having a corporation, owning a corporation, using the corporate form, if you want that, then you have to conduct yourself by certain rules. There's accounting rules, there's taxation rules, and then there's like rules like you got to pay the minimum wage. And I don't know why we can't, as a society, simply say, if you can't do business in this country and pay your workers at least $10 an hour, you have no right doing business. It's just that simple. For example. So, anyway, just some rambling thoughts from the day. Particularly for somebody doing, I mean, you know, treacherous, dangerous, difficult, hot. These people, you know, I flipped burgers at Henry's Hamburgers when I was a teenager. You get a lot of burns from that hot grease.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's tough work. It really is tough work. And all these people are asking for is a decent living wage. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. 1965. Many of you, I realize, were not even alive in 1965. But 1965... an interesting time in American history. David Rosenbaum, in 1985, April 17th, 1985, writes in the New York Times, under an article titled 20 Years Later, The Great Society Flourishes. I shared some of this with you last week. I really think it's worth revisiting, very briefly anyway. That in 1965, half of all Americans over 65 had no health insurance, and a third lived in poverty. Pretty amazing. 90% of all African Americans in the southern counties were not registered to vote, and it wasn't because they didn't want to vote. Only a third of the children in the United States attended kindergarten. 1965. And LBJ's Great Society fixed that in 20 years. And so then in 1985, David Rosenbaum is writing about how Ronald Reagan says, okay, problem solved. Let's just do away with all these, you know, great society programs. It's really quite amazing. Okay. John in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, hey, Tom.
Now it's working.
I do have a comment and a couple questions for you. My comment is that I believe, to sum up most of what many callers do call in about, is there is a moral imperative in our society that we all have value, and that the Republicans, not only in our in the U.S. federal government, but the local state governments and even the city governments, seem to lack that knowledge that we all have value.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my comment on that. The questions I have for you, though, is in 1979 we had the right to work movement throughout the United States. They had states that were voting for right to work, states that were voting against it. You had the unions really come out. I think that was like the zenith of the unions. And from where I'm at here in St. Louis, Missouri, as well as Michigan, and whatever, these states seem to have suffered since then and seen many jobs move to southern states. Prime example is like GM had a GM and Ford and even Chrysler plants here. They ended up moving south into Tennessee, Kentucky, and into southern states where basically even today, if St. Louis is considered a union bastion, is suffering more because they seem to be, many of the people in the area seem to believe in unions, and you have other people saying, well, we're against them. And to me, I look as a union as just a microcosm of our democracy, and I, when people say that they're against them, I can't understand why. Were they against people coalescing and, you know, as our country did, coming together and redressing their grievances? In
I mean, unions are democracy in the workplace. They're one of the few, they are the only democratic institution that exists in the workplace in America, at least in, you know, your traditional corporate form companies. Now, there are companies that are themselves democracies that are cooperatives, but, you know, aside from them, the only way you can have a democracy in the workplace is to have a union. So, yeah, the people who are opposed to unions, in my opinion, are opposed to democracy. At least in the workplace.
I would like to ask Thomas, where do you buy your book?
Which book?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I like to get some of your books that you've written and so I can read them.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, your library should have them. And if they don't, then any of the mass sellers. I mean, my last book, Threshold, was published by Random House? In any case, they're all they've all been published. Each one of them, Threshold, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, Cracking the Code was Barrett Kohler. Last Hours was Random House. The Tom Hartman Reader was Barrett Kohler. These are major publishers, so they should be available in any bookstore. And if they're not, you can simply ask the bookstore to order them. So they're pretty easy to find, pretty easy to track down. John, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, you wanted to talk about redistricting?
Yeah, but first I just want to mention, when you mentioned the Republican Christian perception, it's always fun to ask that type of person, what about Matthew 5 and Matthew 7? You know, the Beatitudes of, you know, the meek, the peacemakers, and the merciful. And then Matthew 7 is, of course, the Golden Rule.
Right.
And can't answer it very well, how our policies work out, you know, the Republican policies work with those.
Yeah, I see the Republican Party, and I think that this is why they flip the stars upside down on their logo, as the essentially anti-Christian, anti-American party, and at least in terms of traditional American values and traditional Christian values, genuine Christian values. And they
so
like,
anyway,
you know, anyhow, yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, so my main point is, it's very frustrating, having worked a lot with politics and where they create bipartisan parties and committees and so forth, especially
right.
ones created with citizens, because over a third, it's actually, I think, nearly 40% now, the public is not either of the main two parties.
Right.
So we always need to have nonpartisan or committees that reflect the actual makeup of the population.
Well, this is in California. It's five Democrats, five Republicans, five independents.
But it should be six independents, I think, if you really want to and less Republicans. The thing is, we need to get rid of this bipartisan meme because that does not reflect the population of the U.S.
Oh, I see your point. Yeah. There are more Democrats, substantially more Democrats in the United States than there are Republicans. And there are more independents than there are Democrats. So if you're going to have a commission, it should be stacked with, you know, seven independents, six Democrats, and five Republicans, for example, to be more reflective of America as a whole.
Yes.
Yeah.
And especially that is one of the things that's keeping the Libertarians and the Greens and all the other parties out, because we keep on doing bipartisan rather than...
Yeah, tri or multi. Yeah. Yeah, I got it. Excellent point, Jeff. Thank you very much. Your thoughtful insights are always so right to the point. It is 27-28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be back with more of Indigo's Summer right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think this is so great. What's going on? Check the news. If you're not seeing this in your local news, these stories about these strikes at these fast food restaurants, ask them why. The good, the bad, and the very, very balbutiantly ugly. The good. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the world-renowned South African cleric, blasted Christian homophobes in remarks made to the Agence France-Presse over the weekend. He said, "I would not worship a God who is homophobic, and that is how deeply I feel about this. I would refuse to go to a homophobic heaven. No, I would say, sorry, I mean, I would much rather go to the other place." Powerful words, indeed. If only more Christian leaders here in the U.S. thought like Archbishop Tutu. The bad. Nina Easton. During an appearance on the special report with Brett Baer last week, the Fortune magazine claimed that voter ID laws aren't discriminatory. Check it out.
Voter ID laws, the idea that these are discriminating, I think is just a liberal ruse to, again, gin up the vote.
Which is nonsense. Just look at the statistics. The percentage of African Americans and Latinos without an official form of identification is way more than that of white Americans. Any law requiring IDs at the polls disproportionately affects minorities and is therefore on its face discriminatory. But if you need even further proof about the real purpose of voter ID laws, take a look or a listen to what Paul Weyrich, co-founder of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which promotes these laws, and the Heritage Foundation, which loves these laws, said back in 1980.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
The only ruse here is the conservative myth that voter fraud is a real problem. And the very, very ugly, Lauren Green, the spirited debate host, is under fire today in the wake of the following exchange she had with theologian Reza Aslan on Friday during a discussion about his new book on the life of Jesus. Check this out.
This is an interesting book. Now, I want to clarify, you're a Muslim, so why did you write a book about the founder of Christianity?
Well, to be clear, I am a scholar of religions with 4 degrees, including one in the New Testament and fluency in biblical Greek, who has been studying the origins of Christianity for 2 decades. I have been obsessed with Jesus.
Though, it still begs the question, why would you be interested in the founder of Christianity?
Let's continue for the rest.
Because it's my job as an academic.
Let's continue for the rest of the 10-minute interview. Aslan should be commended for holding his ground, but let's be honest, no one would ever ask a Christian who wrote a book about Muhammad or about Islam the same stupid question that Green asked Aslan. And that's very, very ugly.
That's incredibly ugly.
Oh, amazing. Koch Brothers Exposed. Ed, you want to tell us about it from Klamath Falls?
Yeah, Oregon? That movie, Koch Brothers Exposed. Apparently, the Koch brothers had it squashed so they couldn't show it on public TV.
Right.
But it's shown up in my future listings on next Monday, the 5th, first thing in the morning on Link TV.
Great. So somebody has picked it up. That's marvelous. That's good. I'm gonna have to look around for that. I hope it makes
it. It'll be 3 o'clock in the morning your time on Link TV.
Yeah.
I'm on the West Coast.
Yeah. Well, I hope it makes it its way to the internet. I mean, so anybody can just see it with a click. Because increasingly, that's how I watch. To the extent that I watch television, most of what I watch these days. If Louise and I want to take an hour or two off on a Saturday afternoon, or some night before we go to sleep, it'll be Netflix. I mean, it's like, who needs television anymore? Lay in bed and watch the computer. So I hope Koch Brothers Exposed makes its way to Hulu or Netflix or something like that. So, Ed, thanks for the call. Alfonso in Elmhurst, Illinois. Hey, Alfonso, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to share an anecdote from my 92-year-old father, which I think is kind of ironic these days. Well, he was born in California, Southern California, in 1920, and he remembers very clearly as a young boy he and his family having to move to Mexico in search of work.
During the Great Depression?
Exactly, the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl years.
Yeah.
There just wasn't a lot of work for farmers. And so migrant farmers were actually, and again, he recalls, a lot of the people going with him were straight up American citizens. He himself is Mexican American, although all his family had lived in the U.S. for generations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, when you think about how the tables have turned and that we're not extending the same courtesy to these folks,
it just
boggles the mind.
Yeah, it does. Very, very well said. And a fascinating anecdote. Thank you, Alfonso. I appreciate the call. And thanks for listening to WCPT. Ronald in Chicago. Hey, Ronald, what's up?
Well, hi, Tom. I wanted to thank you for educating me and giving me the background to contradict some of these nuts that call me. I've gotten robocalls from Newt Gingrich.
Really?
Telling me all the lies about, the scandals and the Obamacare and all this kind of crap. So what I do is I wait until the recording is over, and then they say, well, would you like to sign the petition backing us? And so I say yes. And then when they ask me for my name, I say, Newton Gingrich. And then they say, oh, would you like to make a donation? And so I hit the button, and then I finally get a live person on there. And I tell you, I managed to waste 20 to 30 minutes of this guy's time just by contradicting him every time he came. Like, just an example, he came out with, Obamacare hasn't been implemented yet. I said, well, where do you get your information from? I said, don't you keep up to date? People who were under 26 were able to stay on their, on their parents' private insurance. And,
2 years ago.
Other things he threw out there. And I said, and then he says, well, where do you get your information from? I said, well, radio, newspapers, newspapers. I says, oh, you don't want me to read newspapers? What do you want me to do, get my information from Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh?
And I would suspect his answer would be yes.
and then at the end I says, well, now that you know how I feel, are you still going to ask me for money? Because they were asking for $100 or $200.
Right.
And so he started asking me, and I says, well, I'll tell you what, it's not worth 2 cents, but you just got my 2 cents worth, so I think we'll end there.
Wow.
If anybody gets a robocall from Newt Gingrich, waste the guy's time as much as you can.
Yeah. There was a storyteller up in Vermont when Louise and I lived up there, and he used to come on public radio from time to time, and he was just a brilliant storyteller. It's an old, rural tradition, and particularly in the Northeast. And he and his wife had this competition, and I guess if you're this was a decade ago, but back before everybody had cell phones, but I guess if you're over 60 and you have a listed landline number, a hardwired telephone number, that you get a lot of phone calls from people who want to try and sell you things, and always hoping that they're going to get somebody who's gone a little farther, into dementia and might just be willing to fall for anything, or for that matter, they might just make a sale. I mean, whatever. And so he was. He said he was getting 4 or 5 of these calls a day. It's just incredible. So he and his wife had these elaborate stories. I mean, the person would call and say, "How are you today?" "Well, my back," and then the guy would just, you know, "And how long will can I talk about this until he interrupts me?" And then, you know, he'll ask another question, and you know, their competition was to see who could keep people on the line the longest, right? And they had just hysterical stories about the stories that they told these people and how they got them going. So, Ronald, you are following a fine tradition, and I thank you for sharing it with our listeners, and congratulations. We'll do it. Matthew in Cazenovia, New York. Hey, Matthew, what's up?
Hi, Tom. First, props to the guy who was punking Newt Gingrich. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
But I was... On the issue of entry-level wage versus fair wage, at least that's what the people I talk to call it, because whether or not minimum wage should be entry-level or should actually force employers to pay a decent wage, I actually got inspired by the Australian system, although I don't particularly prefer it in its form, and came up with my own, and I wondered what you thought about it.
What is it?
My idea was for an escalating minimum wage that started at an entry level, like $12 an hour, and escalated over so many years of employment, like 4 years, and slowly went up to something like $15 an hour.
Yeah.
You know, you can see that with the fast food controversy thing that's going on, that people in positions where they're never going to rise up, they're always going to be at that minimum wage job.
Right.
To make sure that they actually get that minimum wage. I mean, a decent wage instead of just the bare minimum entry.
I think it makes
there for years.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I mean, when I was a kid, young man, back in the early 70s, it was the 60s. When I was 14, so it must have been 65. I got this job at Henry's Hamburgers, and I had to get, because I was under 16, I had to get a work permit. My father had to sign off on it, and my school principal had to sign off on it. It was Michigan law at the time, in order for me to enter the workforce, just to work, you know, 3 hours a day, a couple days a week at Henry's Hamburgers. And what that did was it kind of calibrated the workforce. Now we've got a surplus of workers. We didn't then. So, but I think it's a good idea. Thank you, Matthew.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We really need to get out of this downward wage spiral that we're in. I mean, 32 years of Reaganomics has just devastated this country. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Dane in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Dane, you want to talk about wage stagnation?
Yes, I thought I would. There's a lot of talk about wage stagnation, about how it's gone down. I remembered in 1984 making $10 an hour as a newspaper press operator.
And $10 an hour in 84 would probably be close to, what, $16, $18 an hour now?
Probably about that, if not more. I mean, it just shows you how wages have gone down. I've seen ads on Craigslist wanting an associate's degree to make $10 an hour. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, you know.
Yeah. And I've, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I remember Reagan wanting to propose wanting to cut the minimum wage, saying it was going to create more jobs. I mean, that's hogwash. You know?
Yes. Yes. So, every time the minimum wage has increased, GDP has grown. Every time the minimum wage has increased, the wealth of the American people has grown. Every time the minimum wage has increased, the strength of the middle class has grown. And whenever the minimum wage stagnates for long periods of time, and this was the big mistake that Franklin Roosevelt made when he first got the minimum wage passed, was he didn't index it to inflation. And, you know, he really should have. This is what they didn't index Social Security to inflation either, and they had to periodically raise Social Security benefits. And that was Lyndon Johnson's thing. Lyndon Johnson indexed Social Security to inflation and created the whole cost of living increase notion for Social Security. But you're absolutely right, Dane. We are seeing stagnation and wage disintegration. Thanks a lot for the call. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom, long time no talk.
Hey, Sean, it's been years. How are you?
Hey, when are you going to come to Indianapolis? We're up to 87 progressives.
Wow, 87 progressives. That's great.
Hey, if you want to drive an evangelical nuts, send them a birthday card 9 months before their birthday.
Okay.
Hey, I wanted to tell you, I got to meet Michael Hutchison at a disability conference. It's been a while, but he's really amazing.
Yeah. Well, he's passed away now. He passed away last week.
I'm sorry. Was, that's what I meant.
Yeah, he was really amazing.
I brought him up.
Yeah.
And it was sure sorry to see him pass.
Yeah.
But he had a full and amazing life. And, you know, you can just celebrate it.
Yes. Yes,
so,
I agree.
And if there's anybody out there that's going through a disability, you know, you'll be okay. Look what Michael's was able to do.
Yeah.
Heck, look what Stephen Hawking was able to do.
Yeah.
And he can only move his finger.
Yeah. Now, I understand, Sean, last time we talked, that you'd been through a couple hundred surgeries or something.
342.
Say that again?
342.
342 surgeries. My goodness.
Yeah, but it's been 7 years.
Yeah.
Since my last one.
Wow. Well, that's good. I hope
to
you're feeling
honest,
well.
To be honest, I'm running out of body parts for them to cut on.
For them to replace.
So.
Okay. Well, Sean, it's great to hear from you. And thank you know, it's you've been listening to this program and calling into it for, it seems like, 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, since day one.
Yeah.
I can remember the first day.
Wow.
And I said, I am hooked on this guy.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, thank you for being a loyal listener, and it's nice to hear your voice. And when Michael Hutchison spoke at that disability conference, what did he talk about?
What did he talk about? He did some mountain climbing, didn't he?
Uh-huh. Yeah, he did.
Yeah. He had just gotten back from his mountain climbing experience.
Oh, so this was before he broke his neck?
No, it was during.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was talking about when he was a mountain climber before his disability,
mm-hmm.
and he had done some during his, he had done some mountain, not climbing, but he had done some work in the mountains.
Yeah, he lived up in the mountains.
He would do some riding work.
Yeah, he spent a winter living in a snow cave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had a friend that had a cabin.
Yep.
And he went and did all of his riding work.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that cabin.
Remarkable.
Maybe you know where he knows, that you know that same person. But
yeah.
Yeah, he was really amazing.
He was. So. Sean, thank you for the call.
Okay.
It's great to, hear, indeed, great to hear your voice again after all these years. Richard in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom. I miss you in Portland.
Well, we're still accessible a whole wide variety of ways.
Oh, I do DirecTV, Free Speech TV, and SiriusXM satellite radio, so I still
Great.
Get you.
Great.
I have an idea that I'd like all good progressives to call their legislators and talk about. Since the immigration reform has stalled, my idea is that in the path to citizenship, an interview with someone applying for citizenship, providing 5 years work experience, or rather work history, and the wages they were paid will indicate vast numbers of illegal employers paying less than fair wage or less than minimum wage in many cases,
mm-hmm.
and the Justice Department should go back on those employers. That
yeah.
should be part of the immigration.
A large part of the problem is that, Richard, is that a lot of these employers are hiring day labor, and they're paying in cash. And so, you know, so people can't even document that they worked there. And but you're right. We have an illegal employer problem in this country, not an illegal immigrant problem. And I think you've defined it very, very well. Richard, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back tomorrow with all the latest news out of Congress as they prepare for the summer recess. They're getting ready to shut down the government again. Well, that's going to come this fall. Plus, the latest developments on the NSA surveillance scandal, thanks to the Bush administration's Patriot Act. We've given up a lot there. How much is too much? I'll challenge conservative national security analyst Ryan Morrow of the Aquarian Project. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your participation. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.